Sam broke my heart. I thought he was the Mark Zuckerberg of crypto, the revolutionary, the way Mark was on social media, but he turned out to be the Bernie Madoff. It was very, very sad. And I predict he'll get there'll be a guilty conviction in his case.
Do you see factions kind of solidifying within the Republican Party as a result of this?
Well, not yet. Unfortunately, the big gorilla in the room, this orange gorilla, Donald Trump, is wreaking havoc. What I would say to people about the AI bubble is that there are parallels to the Web 1 bubble. Yeah. There are clear winners, okay? NVIDIA is a clear winner. Some of the Bitcoin maxis, the maximalists, want it to become the universal standard of money. I don't think it will. Just asking my opinion, I don't think so. But could it become a store of value for people that in many ways is more valuable than gold? And I believe that that's coming. And I think Bitcoin could easily be a $15 trillion asset. But the bigger problem is, how do you fix the system?
Welcome, Anthony. Great to have you on the show. How are things?
It's good to be here. Things are great.
So people or regular viewers of the Opto Session show will know that we typically do this remotely, or at least in London, where we're based. We're here in New York today. Thanks for inviting us down to your amazing offices.
I appreciate you being here. Thank you.
I want to start with your background, sort of introduce you to anyone that hasn't heard of Anthony Scaramucci. Okay. And last time, I think we interviewed you in about 2019 for our print magazine, and we focused on your political career. I want to understand why you ended up in finance. I think you studied law at Harvard Law. So talk to me why you studied finance, why you went into that.
So I think it's important to apply a little more context. You know, I grew up in a blue-collar neighborhood out on Long Island. Yep. My dad was from a coal mining town, and he moved to Long Island to mine sand. He ended up as a crane operator for 42 years at the same company.
Wow.
But he was in the union, had a very high wage. We grew up in the middle class. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would never dishonor him by telling you I grew up poor.
Sure.
But there was always a little bit of financial tightness and a little bit of a struggle. When I got to college, I didn't know what I wanted to do. There was an article in Time magazine, which was very famous back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And there was an article suggesting that first year lawyers here in New York City could make $65,000 a year. And I remember reading the article and thinking, okay, that's like double what my dad makes today. And I was like, okay, so I know this is very superficial and very shallow thinking, but I made a decision to pivot to go to law school right then and there. And so I took the LSAT, I applied to different law schools, got accepted to Harvard Law School, but I really didn't know a lot about the practice of law. When I got to law school, I enjoyed law school, but I had clerked or worked as a paralegal and a lawyer in various law firms while I was going through law school, and wanted to be on the other side of the transaction. I wanted to be the person getting the advice, sort of doing the deals,
yeah, right,
as opposed to being the advisor. That's just me. Some of my contemporaries have gone on to be amazing lawyers, but I made the decision probably in the middle of law school that I would seek a career outside of the law. And so I can remember crossing the river at Harvard over to the Harvard Business School. I went into the Career Placement Center, and in the Career Placement Center, I met some people from Goldman Sachs and a few other investment banks, interviewed there, and then I got a job at Goldman. So my whole life, I always wanted to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
I wrote in my diary the year that I graduated from law school, that the day that I paid off my student debt, and I had $100,000+ of student debt, which was a lot of money back then, yeah, and I was a kid, that I would start my own business. And so I paid off my debt in May of 1996, and I started my business at the end of Goldman's fiscal year, which at that time it was a private partnership. It ended in December. And so I left Goldman on November 30th. I started my first business on December 1st of 1996, and that led to where I am today, 26 years later, as still an entrepreneur. I sold that business successfully to a publicly traded firm called Neuberger Berman.
Yeah.
Neuberger got bought by Lehman, and I spent a few years at Lehman before I left to start SkyBridge. So SkyBridge will be celebrating its 19th anniversary in March. But since you mentioned these things sort of conjoined, so really, how did I get into politics? And this is an influential part of the story for me. I had no network. And so I just want you to imagine, because you're from the UK, if you go to Eton or you go to Oxford or you go to Cambridge and you're in one of these highfalutin families, you have a pretty good network. I had no network. So even though I went to Harvard, I was a young boy in an old boy's network. I really didn't know anybody. And also, my parents weren't members of any clubs or anything. Dad was blue collar, so I never hit a golf ball, never swung a tennis racket.
Yeah.
And so now they put me in this position at Goldman where I had to bring wealthy individuals into the firm and offer them wealth advice. And so I was like, okay, how am I going to do this? I don't know any of these people. And so I decided that the best entree was through politics. And so I became a young political fundraiser. Yeah. And at the age of 25 in 1989, I wrote my first check to Rudolph Giuliani for mayor. So I was young Republicans for Mayor Giuliani. Yeah. And people often ask me, well, how come you're a Republican? Well, my dad's union was controlled by Republicans. And so this is an interesting distinction to really understand America. Most of the unions in our country are controlled by the Democrats. But out in Nassau County on Long Island, sort of this obscure fact, David Axelrod, Barack Obama's campaign manager, I was on his podcast once. He was like, you know, you're Republicans, your dad's union was controlled by Republicans. And I said, yeah, that's exactly right. And so there was very few counties where that was the case. But so when I registered for the draft, when I was 18, I registered to vote as well. And I registered as a Republican. And so now that I, 7 years later, I'm coming out of school, I said, I must be a Republican. Rudy was running for mayor. And I raised him money. He lost, which was very good for me because now he was mustering up to build another campaign for the 1993 election, and I worked on that with him. And so when he won in 93, that was great for me, and it opened up a lot of doors for me to grow my business. So weirdly, have never had any interest in politics, you know, other than reading it the way you would follow Manchester United or something in your country. I mean, I you know, follow sports and politics, but had no inkling to have a career in politics. Yeah. But I was raising a lot of money as a business executive and as an entrepreneur. I raised money for Mitt Romney. I raised money for George W. Bush. I raised money for Jeb Bush. I raised money for Governor Scott Walker from Wisconsin. And then, of course, I raised a ton of money for Donald Trump. And this was later on, but he wasn't a traditional Republican. And I was always sided with the traditional Republicans. When they came out of the race, I made the ominous decision to go work for Trump, which has cost me a lot, but I've also benefited a lot from it too. So it was a, sort of a weird outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Ultimately, we hadn't planned to discuss this, but do you see factions kind of solidifying within the Republican Party as a result of this?
Well, not yet. Unfortunately, the big gorilla in the room, this orange gorilla, Donald Trump, is wreaking havoc in that party. And so I don't see a consolidation of power. Moreover, you need sort of a transformative leader, almost like a Barack Obama for Republicans, you know, so someone that's sort of center right, but that can re-knit the coalition together. The Republicans are also losing registration on a percentage of population. So if you look at the totals now, the independents have the people that declare themselves as independents are the highest voting group now, followed by the Democrats. Republicans are at 29%. Democrats are at 33%. So it would be incumbent upon the Republicans to think like entrepreneurs and go out there and create a new market for themselves. Make the party look like the beautiful, colorful mosaic of the American people. And there's ample opportunity to do that because there's 144 million very powerful voting bloc in this country, 144 million people. They vote the exact same way in every election. You say, well, who's that voting bloc? It's the non-voter. Okay, we have literally less than 50% voter participation in most of our voting. And so I just want you to imagine if we had a politician or a leader that could reach into that marketplace and explain to those voters that they need to get back involved and that we need to reduce the cynicism, create more of an aspirational laboratory for our youth and aspirational laboratory for our lower and middle classes. You know, The problem in the UK, if you don't mind me being so forward about this, because I don't like talking about other people's politics, but it's very similar to the problem in the United States. There's a very large group of people that have disaffected from the system. These are the people I grew up with. I recognize these people. They went to a public school, a public high school. They never got formally educated in a college, and they are working with their hands. But the problem is, because we're monetizing all this debt and we're cheapening the pound or cheapening the dollar, they're losing their living standards. I can remember being with Mr. Trump on a campaign stop in 2016 and talking to people in New Mexico. And one gentleman said to me, oh, you know, you think you're in New Mexico, but New Mexico, that would be Mexico, because that's where my job moved to. And I remember getting back on the campaign plane with him, and I was looking up my dad's local union on the internet, and I was looking up what his wages were, and because I remember his wages when I was a kid, and I was doing an analysis, and I told then-candidate Trump, I told Mr. Trump that my dad's wages are down 26% in real economics in terms of the purchasing power. A result of which we're not in the middle class. You know, we go into some economic dependency on the government, or, you know, we're near the poverty line. And that creates a lot of anxiety. And so your country and my country, the people I grew up with, they felt economically aspirational. I grew up in a blue-collar, working-class family that was economically aspirational. One of their kids was going to go to college and work indoors. You know, my dad used to always tease me. He says, never complain about your job. You know, you're indoors, you're out of direct sunlight, and there's no heavy lifting. Yeah. That's the family I grew up in. And so we took these aspirational working class people and we turned them into economically desperational in 35 years. It happened in your country as well. And so in June of 2016, I was with Mr. Trump campaigning, and he looked at me, this is about 2 weeks before the Brexit results, and there was mixed polling. I think a lot of your people, there's something called the Bradley effect. He was an African-American mayor in L.A., and people weren't going to vote for him a second time, but because he was black, they didn't want to be perceived as racist. And so when they called him on the phone and said, are you going to vote for Mayor Bradley? They said yes. But they didn't. And something like that was happening in your country. Trump saw it, and you guys ended up Brexiting. Now, I think it was an economic mistake for you guys, and I think it's shrunken the economy, and it's actually created a worse situation for those people. I understand the nationalism associated with it, and I understand the ties back to the nostalgia of nationalism, but you know, it's just a crisis of leadership, because if your leadership or our leadership had appropriately explained things to these people, they're smart enough to have made the right decision.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, it's a communication problem as much as anything. I want to touch, kind of, we've discussed economics loosely there, and obviously that'll be the focus of today's interview. But before we go through, I'm going to reference some quotes from some interviews you've run on your own podcast, Open Book, which I think you launched earlier this year in January. I'm just keen to hear kind of why you decided to launch that podcast. Like, tell us about it and why you're interested in podcasting.
Well, I love books. You know, I've been a big reader my whole life. And I love interesting authors. You know, I tell people, this is no longer true because of inflation. I used to tell people for $10 and 10 hours, you can get 10 years of experience from reading a book. Now it's probably $25 or $30. But the point being is that an author, let's say we were going to, you know, we were discussing Franklin Roosevelt earlier. Let's say we were going to read a book on Franklin Roosevelt, a biography. Well, that author could have probably worked 2 years on that biography. You or I could read it in 10 or 12 hours. And we learned so much dense information. And so I'm always curious about an author who's willing to sit down, who doesn't have the attention deficit disorder that I have, and they can actually sit down and focus and actually write a book of that caliber. I'm interested in learning from that person, interested in learning their personality traits. I mean, one of the UK authors I'm very fond of is Andrew Roberts. He's written several great biographies, most recently about Winston Churchill. He's been on my podcast, but so has Ken Follett, the great British fictional novelist who's written so many of these great historical fictions, which really tie in a lot of fact. So he's one of my favorites as well. He comes on my podcast. Daniel Silva, the spy novelist. I've had a whole Walter Isaacson, the great American biographer. And so for me, I'm a little bit of a book nerd. And so I like reading the book, which always surprises the author.
Yeah, I read the book,
and now we're talking about the book, and I can actually cite pages in the book, and the guy's like, whoa, or she's like, whoa. Yeah. And it becomes an interesting conversation. So there's a double entendre with the title. I'm an open book. If you ask me a question, I'm going to tell you an honest answer. But I think opening a book is also a really cool thing to do. And there's a lot of people that write to me and tell me, you know, I don't have the time to read a book. But if you find it interesting, it's cool to hear you discuss the book with the author.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I'm going to come back to a few of those interviews. But before I do, our print magazine, the next issue is publishing at the start of November. And that will focus almost exclusively on AI. So I'm going to touch on that for a second and get your thoughts there. I listened to a Bloomberg interview you did recently where you described Taiwan as the Saudi Arabia of chip manufacturing. How concentrated is chip manufacturing at the moment?
Well, right now it's very concentrated. I mean, we are making finally some chips here in the U.S. Some chips are obviously made in Europe. The U.S. has made a decision. We can debate the merits of the decision to sanction and block off some of those chips, which are integral to AI for the Chinese economy and for the development of the Chinese AI systems. But 90%+ of the chips that we need to advance the economy are made in Taiwan. And so, listen, we can argue about this, and I can take you through 50+ years of U.S.-Chinese diplomatic history, but I can tell you where we are right now is not where I would like us to be. We have two systems. The United States sometimes has a tendency to be righteous, but yet we can sit here and I can list to you mistakes the United States has made in the Middle East over the last 20 years. Moreover, I don't agree with certain policies that the Chinese government has as it relates to free press and individual freedoms and the way they censor things and so forth. But it is their system. And I think it is very difficult for us to be sanctimonious towards each other. We would be better served being more interconnected. And so an author that I'm very fond of, who's the dean of the Kennedy School of Government, his name is Graham Allison. He wrote a book about 8 years ago called Destined for War. And this is the Thucydides trap. This is the ancient Greek historian who wrote about the Peloponnesian War. And basically, what is that trap? A rising superpower generally threatens the existing superpower. And if you study history over 2,000 years, 12 out of the 16 times that that's happened, we have gone to war. On four occasions, we haven't. The most recent one was the decline of the British Empire and the rise of America. And so he writes in the book, well, why didn't that happen? Well, we're sort of kissing cousins. We have the same language. We have the same common law practices. By and large, at the time of that dislocation, we were Christian nations, by and large. Yeah. And so we didn't feel that there was a need for conflict. If anything, we felt there was a need for an alliance and towards helping each other. Yeah. But invariably, or I should say, you know, 2/3 of the time, you get in trouble with a power like China rising and threatening the American-centric world that we've all been living in since after World War II. So there's two ways to handle that. You can get bowled up and antagonistic and offer a bellicosity of rhetoric and force your war games on each other and then accidentally enter into a conflict, which leads to a hot war, which would be an unmitigated disaster for the world. Or you can be more rational and find ways to seek common ground, both economically and seek common ground as it relates to things that are important to us, whether it's terrorism, the environment, all these sort of interests that we have as human beings, you know. And so for me, I'm worried about it. But, you know, Taiwan is a big worry because whether you like it or not, the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, views that as part of Taiwan. The United States, I mean, views that as part of China, Taiwan. And we, the United States, has a one China policy. And so we've offered protection, and we've offered a declaration that we would defend Taiwan in an invasion. And I think we would right now, frankly, because of what we just talked about with the semiconductors. It would be in our economic interest to do that, but it would be more in our economic interest to not have to do that. And so, you know, we need smarter politicians, politicians that understand the historical framework of very large superpowers getting on with each other as opposed to fighting with each other. And so it's easier to do after big conflicts. It's harder to do when you've had peace and prosperity for 80 years. You didn't come here for a history lesson, but you should listen to this. Barbara Tuchman wrote in The Guns of August that the great accident of the Second World War was the antagonism, the rising bellicosity of rhetoric, the antagonism towards nationalism, the militarism. And so when the conflict started, all parties thought it would be a short-lived conflict. Vladimir Putin, by the way, fast forward, he thought it was a short-lived conflict. Dick Cheney thought it was a short-lived conflict. They all both ended up being longer than they thought. And of course, the Great World War, which in many ways we're still fighting today, if you just look at what's going on in the Middle East, et cetera, that Great World War cost us 40 million lives. And it was totally off the mark of what they originally thought was going to happen. And what Tuchman writes in the book is that we have this systemic rise of nationalism when we lose our wartime real-life history. And so the Napoleonic Wars wreaked havoc on the European continent. Von Metternich, Congress of Vienna, they built a coalition for peace and a balance of powers among the nations. There were still conflicts. I mean, there was a French and German conflict in 1848, but by and large, the continent had 100 years of peace. When you got to 1914, there was nobody left that remembered the war. And so we have a tendency, men do, by the way, more so than women, but we have a tendency to glorify war. We have a tendency to thrust ourselves into it with this great spirit. And then, of course, after the conflict, where civilians have died, our sons and daughters have died in the war, we seek unity. That's what happened to the European common market. They were like, okay, we can't do this anymore, brought themselves together. But then now they're victims of the peace and prosperity that all of that unification brought them. So there's no living to speak of. I mean, there are people in their late 90s that are still alive, but there's no politicians or public servants that served in that war that can remember the horror of that war. And so, again, I think we need transformational leadership. We need people in leadership that can apply a historical context to something, explain to people, hey, when the war starts, you have no idea how it's going to end, and you have no idea who's going to get pulled into the conflict. And, you know, you're not going to like me saying this, and your viewers and listeners are not like me saying this. We got a war going on right now. We're in a war. Okay, if the UK is sending arsenal and equipment to the Ukraine, well, you know, they're contributing to the war. The same way the United States in 1940, in May of 1940, when Churchill rose to power, Roosevelt figured out ways to create Lend-Lease. Yeah. He was prohibited from a legal structure in the U.S. from selling them the equipment, okay, but he was okay with lending it to them, okay? So he found that distinction. He went on the air and gave a fireside chat about lending a garden hose to his neighbor who was on fire, and the American people accepted it, and the Congress allowed for it, and so Lend-Lease was applied. And so we were funding the Russians, Soviet Union, and the Brits before we got into the war in December of 41. So anybody that's telling you we're not in the war is being unfair. They're being unfair, and they're being slightly untruthful with their words. The UK, the United States, the members of NATO are in the war. We're fighting a proxy war with Russia. Your politicians are not going to tell you that, but that's the truth. And we would be better served figuring out a way to end that war. Now, I understand what the vested interests are and so forth, and I am a supporter of a free Ukraine. But we do have to figure out a way to end that war.
Absolutely. And we started that conversation talking about semiconductors and the kind of geopolitical tensions in the Taiwan region. How credible do you think the threat is of Taiwan-China reunification?
I think the threat is credible in the sense that could there be a struggle there in the next decade? I think anybody rational that understands the long-term situation and understands the current leadership in the Chinese Communist Party, I think you'd have to say yes, over the next decade, I think that that threat is real. Is the near-term threat a problem? I don't think the near-term threat is a problem, and I'll speak somewhat plaintively and somewhat cynically. The United States is not going to allow for the Taiwanese government to be subsumed by China through force currently. She's not going to allow for it because we just got done talking about 90% of the semiconductors are being produced in Taiwan, and we need that for our economy, and we're not going to blunder or blow our economy. And that's what those troops are there for. And we do still have military superiority over the Chinese. They know that. If you look at our aircraft carrier count, you look at our missile technology, all the different ABM technology that we have relative to them, et cetera, they may have a larger army. But we have a better trained and a better organized, better technology in our army than them. And that may not last forever, okay, but it's there right now. And it would be an unbelievable, unmitigated disaster for the CCP to do something today. Because why run the risk of hurting yourself so badly that you cause a crisis of government or a potential overthrow of that party leadership? So I don't see a near-term threat, but I do see a longer-term threat. But here's the thing. What did we learn from the Hong Kong situation? In 97, the Brits gave up the colony of Hong Kong. It was one party, two systems. It's become one party, more or less one system. Now, they'll argue differently. They'll say that there's probably easier freedoms in Hong Kong, but the spread has narrowed. If you're just looking at it clinically, and you can invite legal scholars onto your podcast if you want to, and they can prove to you through empiricism that that spread between the freedoms, press freedoms, civil liberty freedoms, rights of a potentially accused victim of, you know, a criminal, I should say, someone that's been accused of a crime, all of that stuff has narrowed and looks more closely like mainland China. Again, I'm not here to judge it or not. I'm just here to observe it. And I think one of the mistakes that we made in 1997 is that, and maybe perhaps it was impossible to do anything to protect those liberties, but we need to be thinking about that today as it relates to Taiwan. Because listen, you want to be in a free society, and you step back and just take a look at the globe. You have 5.5 billion people that are not in free societies. And free societies, look at the prosperity here. Whatever our strengths and weaknesses are as a country, or whatever your strengths and weaknesses are as a country, we have a tendency to be very hard on ourselves. Okay, but I mean, somebody with my upbringing could never have done what I've done in hardly any other country other than this country. And so these are amazing places because there's still levels of meritocracy. Certainly there's an aristocracy, but there's still levels of meritocracy where people can rise. And you have to know that in totalitarian regimes, it is way more difficult because ultimately what happens is the autocrat looks great for the first 10 years. You know, Mussolini got the trains to run on time, but then they go into full lunacy because of what Lord Acton said, you know, the power corrupts. You know, we're not designed for power. Okay, our founders understood that the people that built your monarchical system, mm-hmm. parliamentary system, understood that. Mm-hmm. King John understood that. Mm-hmm. Okay, you have to give away power, mm-hmm. okay, to allow for other people to partake in it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'll lead to some high level of dystopia. And so mm-hmm. so the autocrat can make its way, the autocracy makes its way for 10 years. Everyone loves it. The economy's booming. The trains are running on time. And then the crony capitalism sets in where there's a feeding frenzy by the autocrats' friends at the top. And then the whole structure gets weakened because the rule of law gets weakened. Once you lose the predictability of the rule of law, you lose the nation. Okay? And so we can't, you know, we have to figure that out. And we have to protect the Taiwanese people. The Chinese government's not going to like me saying that. I have a lot of respect for China, and I have a lot of respect for their way of life and Chinese culture, and I'm a long-term thinker, and I want us to have peace and harmony with them. But the flip side is the status quo, or what we talk about as it relates to diplomacy, this ambiguity, okay, has served us well for almost 80 years, and I would like that status quo to stay in place, because if you live in the United States and you love the United States and whatever our strengths or weaknesses are, we have to be there as a beacon of hope for other people to help them live in freedom. Because we know that more people live in freedom, greater economic interdependency of free people, way less war. Democracies typically don't go to war against each other. You could look at that.
Yeah.
By and large, that doesn't happen.
Fantastic. No, I think that sets the context perfectly, because the reason I brought up semiconductors, because I suppose I want to discuss AI. We've set the geopolitical even context for why semiconductor markets are kind of acting the way that they are. But if we move on to AI, people in some quarters, I suppose, are discussing that market or characterizing it as a bubble. So are we in an AI bubble?
Yeah. I mean, look, we won't know until after the fact. We probably are in an AI bubble. Of course, I'm getting old now, so I can tell you when we were in a Web 1 bubble. After the fact, we all felt it. It was March of 2000 where the NASDAQ cratered and went down probably 65-ish plus percent over the ensuing months.
Do you see parallels between those two?
I do. Mm-hmm. But here's what I would say to people. You know, if you allow for your emotions to ride you out of things or ride you into things, it's a very dangerous way to invest, or it's a very dangerous way to think about the economy. So Amazon, I hate this story because it doesn't reflect well on me, but I'll tell it anyway. I went to a meeting. Jeff Bezos gave a presentation and he said, you know, you guys are measuring me as an internet bookseller. It was $19.99. Of course, this would be wildly expensive for an internet bookseller. Mm-hmm. But I'm way more than that. I'm using books as a way to dot plot the logistics of the United States and figure out where my warehouses should go. And then eventually I'm going to be an everything seller. I'm going to corner the market in online retailing. And so it's going to cost me a lot of money. The bad news is I'm going to lose money. But the good news is when I turn the switch on, it's going to be very profitable. And I'm going to have a logistics machine that will lead to a lot of cost synergies and people saving time and energy going to the shopping mall, et cetera.
Sure.
And so I was like ecstatic. I said, okay, I got to go buy this stock. And then the next person to speak was Warren Buffett. He came on the stage and said, oh, Jeff Bezos is a nice, lovely young man, but let me just say this to you. His internet bookseller is worth more than the storied Sears Roebuck. Of course, Sears is now out of business, by the way.
Yeah.
And then Mr. Buffett proceeded to say that it was burning money for 10 years and it was a technology stock and anything could derail it. And so I never bought the stock.
Okay.
But let me just say this. If you put $10,000 into that stock the day that I had heard that presentation, which was in 1999, and you stayed with it until 2023, you had $14 million in your account. Meaning you would have gone through eight periods of time where Amazon lost at least 50% of its value. And in 2000, after the NASDAQ crash, it went from 116 to 9. And who has the stomach for that? Nobody. Okay, someone would have sold it. Yeah. And so what I would say to people about the AI bubble is that there are parallels to the Web 1 bubble.
Yeah.
There are clear winners, okay? NVIDIA is a clear winner, okay? And so it may be up, it may be down, it could get cut by 50% once the quote-unquote bubble bursts. Yeah. But I'm willing to bet you if you hold that stock for 15 years, if you're brave enough, you'll be very well served. So we probably are in a bubble, but that shouldn't dissuade people from getting a toehold in that group of stocks or thinking about the future that way, because it is going to transform us. Somebody said to me that Web 1 was going to transform us. And everyone looked around back in 1996, 97 and rolled their eyes and said, this is a clunky piece of machinery. But look at where it is today. You know, let's say I had beamed back to my younger version of myself in 1998. I was sitting at a fat box computer with a dial-up internet modem. And somebody came to me from 2023 and said, hey, 25 years later, you're going to be having a smart computer in the palm of your hand. You're going to have access to the world's information. And oh, by the way, you're going to be able to stream. There'll be billions of people streaming 4K video, and there'll be billions and billions of dollars of transactions happening over this thing known as the internet.
Yeah.
So we have to remember there's great progress in our societies, and there's incremental progress. Mm-hmm. But just think about where the internet was in 98. With 4% saturation in the global market. Think about where it is 25 short years later. And if you were brave enough to invest in things like Microsoft and Google and eventually Facebook and those others, you did very, very well. Mm-hmm. I think it's important for investors to apply that context to AI.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you think about AI stocks as a category, do you think about companies like NVIDIA as a semiconductor mm-hmm. manufacturer? Do you think about big tech, or do you think about adjacent industries even, like cloud, security, et cetera? Mm-hmm. Are these all good investments, or do you target a particular niche?
So ChatGPT was not yet public. Mm-hmm. You can get a pass-through investment in that through something like Microsoft. Google has its own AI. Facebook has its own AI. Obviously, NVIDIA is basically making the brain for AI, okay, is making the circuitry. Yeah. And so I think all of these things are good investments. You're asking about cloud computing. It's a little off the definition for me for AI,
sure.
But I get why cloud computing has been so successful and why it's such a good investment. And I just want to point out, because I'm, like I said, I'm getting old. When cloud computing came out,
yeah.
And somebody came to your office and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take all the confidential data on your server, which is underneath your desk or in my server room, mm-hmm. and we're going to move it to someone else's server. And you're looking at them like, you're crazy. I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, if you do that, it's going to be a lot cheaper. Okay, and then they give you the example of like in 1900, we had our own electric generators at our houses. And we did away with those, and now we have a power station that's electrifying the whole power grid of a city,
yeah.
And it's way cheaper, it's way more cost efficient, and oh, by the way, in many ways, the cloud is safer than having it under your desk. Yeah. And oh, by the way, it's way lower cost. Okay, so in the beginning, nobody wanted to do it. But here's the thing I will tell you, is I have found in my 35 years of investing, if you have a better product, it's faster, it's more efficient, and it's cheaper.
Yeah.
It gets adopted. You know, there were horse and buggies out here 150 years ago. Mm-hmm. When the horseless carriage came by, people said, oh, that's a fad. But it was easier, faster, cheaper. Mm-hmm. It gets adopted. And that's going to happen with AI. Mm-hmm. It's going to replace a lot of people's jobs. I'm not saying that's going to be a bad thing. Okay, there are no horse and buggy, there's like 10 horse and buggy people here in New York now, and they're for the tourists.
Yeah.
Not a bad thing, because it will innovate and it will lead to a quantum leap in living standards for the world.
Yeah.
So it's generally a good thing, and people need to be invested in it, I think. You know, I'm invested in it.
Yeah, well, I'm glad we got onto your investments. We'll focus on those more specifically later on in the interview, but are you invested in private market sort of AI related investments? I'm interested in understanding kind of whether you're in the private market space as well as public, because I did see reports of you linked as the lead bidder for SVB VC arm.
Yeah.
So I was interested to understand whether there was a link between those two things.
Yeah, so I don't know who leaked that, but I sort of can't talk about that because I signed a confidentiality. But here's what I will say to you. We are in the cryptocurrency space. We have a ton of cryptocurrency on the balance sheet of Skybridge. So I'm not just talking about investing clients' money in the stuff. We have it on our balance sheet. We're about to launch a Skybridge-based AI ETF, which is basically looks like the portfolio of stocks that we've purchased personally. And so my research team and the people that are allocating capital here at Skybridge are building a portfolio of publicly traded securities that are linked to artificial intelligence that will be grouped into an ETF. And what's different about that grouping versus the current AI ETFs that are out there, you more or less brought this up. You know, there's too much Microsoft and there's too much cloud computing and there's too much of that, this will be more focused on what is directly publicly traded that you can access right now in the AI space. You asked about the private markets for AI. Currently, I don't have any private market investments in AI. I do have some private market investments in cryptocurrency and servicers to the cryptocurrency and the digital economy, but I don't have anything in the AI space right now.
Got it. And when's that ETF going live?
So I'm hoping to launch that by January 1st.
Fantastic. One to watch out for. Okay. We've talked about crypto there. I think that's a nice juncture to move on to. I want to discuss the future of money. I've termed this section of the interview, but to start, let's get the context. Let's understand the current monetary system. I listened to a podcast you did with Lynn Alden, a former guest of the Opto Sessions podcast, actually. And she described money as effectively a ledger that we all agree to use, and fiat currencies essentially entrust the management of that ledger to central banks. So I want to start there with that as a loose definition of money, and we'll return to it. But before we move on, how effectively do you think the Fed are managing that ledger at the moment?
Okay, I just want to add a few things. If you don't mind, I would encourage your viewers and listeners to read The Ascent of Money by Neil Ferguson, fellow Brit. He's a great guy, but he explains our relationship with money, and there's a confusion about the money, right? Because we have something, and I'll just take it out of my pocket, as I always bring props to a fun interview like this. Okay, so you see these are, in my neighborhood, we call these Italian singles, okay? These are $100 bills, yeah? But look at them. They're made of cotton. About 75% of this is cotton. 25% of it is linen. There's a little counterfeiting strip in there to protect people. But this is, I know we're not in a philosophy class at uni, but this is effectively worthless. Right, it's just a piece of cloth that I have in my pocket, and it's got some numbers on it and a dead founding father on it. But it's basically worthless, right? Yet if I give this to the maitre d' tonight at the restaurant, he's going to be a very happy camper. Okay, and if it was a 100-pound note, he'd be even more happy, right, because it's worth more. Point I'm making is we've made a decision that we trust this. We trust that if I hand this to you, you can hand it to somebody else and get something for it. So let's start by saying that the money is a technology that we're using between ourselves so we don't have to barter with each other. Okay, now we don't like each other and we don't trust each other. I mean, you seem like a nice guy. Maybe you and I will end up liking each other. But I'm talking about the human beings in general. We're tribal, we stick to our own, and we don't like and we don't trust each other. So we get the money from third parties, okay? And so therefore, we have to have it sanctified by somebody else. Secondarily, if I'm going to go buy your house, you know, you're going to wait for your corresponding bank to tell you that the money is in your account before you hand me the deed to your house. So we always have a third party in the mix helping us do these transactions. So what if you created through the forces of technology this wonderful delayering mechanism? And this delayering mechanism was such that I could send from my wallet to your wallet without that third party. My wallet to your wallet, you actually know you've gotten the money because it's completely sanctified and verified by the internet. This digital electric force, my money goes into your account immediately. It's completely verified. You know it's in your account. I get the deed. We've just taken out all of these intermediaries. So now you have this massive cost savings. You have this massive opportunity to use that capital for innovation. One quick example, I own a restaurant down the block from here called the Hunt and Fish Club. If you went into the restaurant and you paid for your bill with American Express or MasterCard or Visa, the restaurants charge 3.5% for that. So let's say you had a $100 bill, the restaurant would get $96.50 because there would be $3.50 going to MasterCard or Visa. But what if we could do a wallet-to-wallet transfer? So the waiter comes over to your table and says, here's our wallet. You wire it electronically, and now we've bypassed MasterCard and Visa. So that restaurant has a 15% gross margin. We just improved that to 18.5%. So we have a 20+% increase in the gross margin. Think of what we can do with that. We can build another restaurant, buy better food, pay our staff more. And so when you understand the blockchain the way I'm describing it, mm-hmm. it's this wonderful delayering mechanism that's going to allow for permissionless trading. We don't get the permission from the bank. Right. We can transact with each other. And we don't have to like or trust each other, but we can trust the blockchain. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so when Lynn Alden talks about this, and she wrote a great book called Broken Money, okay, which I, you know, read, and I would encourage your viewers and listeners to read the book. What she said about this is that this works until governments eventually start to corrupt the system. Okay, and so maybe we started with wampum or seashells, and then maybe the Romans said, okay, we're going to take metal like silver or gold, put the Roman emperor's face on it. Oh, wait a minute, we're going to put some lead in that gold. We're going to put more lead, and we're going to just coat it with gold. Yeah. And we have a tendency, our natural tendency is to devalue the money. Been doing that for 5,000 years. And so what ends up happening is the people that own assets are protected, but the people like my dad who work with their hands for their money, they're not protected. And why are they not protected? They're not protected because they don't have any assets. You give me $1,000 today and you have 8% inflation, well, now I have $920 worth of purchasing power. You screwed me. Yeah. That's a form of silent taxation. Even your prime minister brought that up in one of his interviews recently, that the inflation is a silent form of taxation. And so that's a disaster for the middle class. Now, Calvin Klein, the very famous American fashion designer, he bought a beautiful home in East Hampton, New York, on the beach in 1987. He spent like $4 million for it. I mean, a year or two ago, he sold that home for $86 million. Okay, so if you got the assets and people are inflating the money or cheapening the money, the assets will move up yeah. with the fiat currency.
Yeah.
But the middle and lower class, they get screwed. They get absolutely hammered. And so you're asking me about how the Fed is doing. By and large, the Fed is doing well, but the system is broken. The money is broken. So if you hand me something that's broken, I can't necessarily fix it.
Yeah.
I can try to make sure there's like less inflation. I can try to make sure I stabilize it a little bit. Oh, but wait a minute. My government is spending 43 cents more than they're actually taking in.
Yeah.
So they have to borrow 43 cents for every dollar that they're spending. Oh my God, how am I going to fix that? Oh, by the way, I have to pay that money back, but I can never really pay it back with money that's worth the same amount. This is why deflation is so damaging. Suppose the money that I borrowed is I have to pay it back with dollars that are worth more than I borrowed.
Yeah.
Right? Now that's a nightmare. That's how you have a full-on depression.
Yeah.
And so the Fed is in a box.
Yeah.
So they're doing a good job in a broken system, but the system's broken. So somebody like Lynn Alden would say to you, well, what if you had an immutable asset?
Yeah.
Something that was defined by its scarcity, it couldn't be replicated, and you could use that ledger, that very transparent ledger, for us to transact with each other. And so that ledger exists, is known as Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Now, will it become, as some of the Bitcoin maxis, the maximalists want it to become, the universal standard of money? I don't think it will. Just asking my opinion, I don't think so. But could it become a store of value for people? Mm-hmm. That in many ways is more valuable than gold. And I believe that that's coming. And I think Bitcoin could easily be a $15 trillion asset. It's a $500 or $600 billion U.S. asset today.
Yeah.
And so we own a lot of Bitcoin here for those reasons. But the bigger problem is, how do you fix the system? Because the system is broken. Now, I'll tell you, the system is fixable because, you know, men... We always have to say men and women now because we're like so focused on pronouns, but it was really men, because it was really men that destroyed us. Okay, we're men in government, blew up the system. There are women entering the government now. So men caused the problem. Maybe men and women will fix the problem, but men caused the problem. And it's fixable. But here's the bad news about fixing it. It would take 15 or 20 years to fix it. And our politicians, particularly in a democracy, they don't think in long-term periods of time.
No.
You know, the Chinese, they have a plan. You look it up on the net. You know, They have a plan for 2049. That's the 100th anniversary of their revolution. They've got 50-year plans for their infrastructure, 25-year plans for this. We have no plan. Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't know one American politician that says, here's our 10-year plan to fix our infrastructure, yeah. our 10-year plan to fix education. Mm-hmm. But these problems are fixable, mm-hmm. Including the deficit, but they would require long-term bipartisan commitment and long-term strategic planning. Mm-hmm. And so if we're not going to do that, which sounds like we've decided we're not going to do that, we'll increase the debt limit.
Yeah.
We won't be able to find the money. We'll lend the money to ourselves by manufacturing it electronically. We'll put it on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. And we're causing ourselves a problem. Over time, when the interest rates are such where the amount of interest we're spending is greater than our military defense budget, and it starts to eat away at everything, people will lose confidence in that system. And so we need, again, transformational leadership to step in and say, okay, this system, which we really broke it in 1971, we took U.S. off the gold standard. It lasted for 52 years, but look at what we did. We took the dollar from $35 an ounce to $2,000 an ounce, so we destroyed the U.S. dollar. We did it because we wanted to monetize these debts and support all these different people, but it's not sustainable, and so we have to come up with a new plan. And somebody's going to have to do that. And if we don't do that, you're going to end up living in barbed-wired McMansions with your own security while you're stepping over homeless people in the street. Okay, and I don't want that to happen, but that's starting to happen.
No, of course. But where does this persistent devaluation of the dollar fiat currencies end? What does that end game look like?
Oh, you mean if you wanted to fix it? You would have to set up a benchmark and some parameters. The first thing you'd have to do is you'd have to go back to the American Congress. Mm-hmm. You know, Clinton, I have a lot of respect for because George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush's dad, okay, when he got the presidency, Bush 41, he said, okay, we had a lot of deficit spending to bring down the Soviet Empire. We ran the deficits up in the 80s, let's put guardrails on the Congress. And there was this legislation called pay-as-you-go in the United States. And so if you wanted to raise social services, you had to raise taxes. If you wanted to cut taxes, you had to find a cut in the budget. Okay, so there were guardrails put in place. And he said, if we do this for 10 years, we'll start running budget surpluses. And so he put it in place. He signed the legislation. Unfortunately for him, we had the Gulf War. And we went into a recession, and so we ended up raising taxes to increase our social services spending because of the unemployment numbers. Yeah, yeah. And that cost Bush the election because he said at the convention in 1988, read my lips, no new taxes. Mm-hmm. But because he signed this pay-as-you-go legislation, he raised taxes. Lost the election to Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton gets the job. He wants to massively increase governmental spending and social services. Robert Reich, the labor secretary, says, why don't you do that through deficit spending? Mm-hmm. Bob Rubin says, okay, no, you can't do that. Adhere to Bush's pay-as-you-go. It'll strengthen the dollar. It'll send a message to the global economy that we're going to be fiscally conservative with our money.
Yeah.
It'll increase foreign investment in the United States. And Clinton, thank God, is a very smart guy, Rhodes Scholar from Oxford. He said, I'm going to go with Bob Rubin as opposed to Bob, the Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich. And he raised the taxes and increased the social spending. Remember, the Republicans didn't vote for it. He got it done. And by the end of 2000, we were running a budget surplus. So the campaign between Gore and Bush was about what are they going to do with the $5 trillion CBO budget surplus by the end of 2010. Of course, we blew that with 9/11.
And
you could go back to that, and it would take 20 years, and you would right-size this thing, and you could fix it.
Okay. But say we don't fix it, and say we look for a new system.
You don't fix it, you'll have $100 trillion of debt. It'll take about another 25 years to do that. You'll have infrastructure decline, middle class and lower middle class decline in the United States. We'll get bailed out a little by our technology, okay, because I'm a big believer. I'm an anti-Tom Malthus. Okay, so Malthus said that we were going to run out of food, yeah, and the population was going to grow exponentially. And of course, he left out all the great technologies. We have more people dying from obesity than we do from starvation.
Got it.
But the point I'm making is we'll get bailed out. Some of this will bail us out. You know, somebody said to me 15 years ago, well, we're spending 20% of our dough on healthcare. The population's aging. That's going to go up to 30%.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, there's no way that's going to happen because the medical technology is going to improve, and it did.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the numbers have actually gone down. If you look at Medicare on a per capita for per patient, even though the patients are older, the cost of their care has gone down. The same way your flat screen television was $5,000 in 2005, it's $600 today. And it's a way better television. So some of the stuff will happen because of our progress. We'll bail ourselves out through some of our technology. But it's such a big problem, unless the government starts to tackle it, it's going to create a lot of wealth gapping.
Yeah.
And it's going to take a very big spread between the rich and the poor. And the rich is stupid, if you don't mind me saying so, because, you know, it's like what Teddy Roosevelt said to the robber barons, you know, come on, guys, you need 14 bedrooms and 65 bathrooms. Why don't you give a bathroom to the forgotten man out here, help the guy out, so he doesn't come after you with a tiki torch and a shotgun.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I completely see what you mean. I want to kind of discuss, I guess, what you see Bitcoin being rolled out, this global savings asset, you know, if that is the new monetary system or part of the new monetary system that we're looking to build, kind of practically what that actually looks like. I want to get a better sense of that. I think the listeners do too. But before we move on to that, there's some pretty significant headwinds, I suppose, getting in the way of us actually rolling this thing out. One might be, for example, regulatory certainty, which it seems to me the U.S. are behind on, potentially. I don't know whether you agree.
Well, I mean, listen, I mean, one of the great things about the U.K., at least right now, or Europe in general, is you have a lot of young leaders that are in positions. We have like 200-year-old fossils like running our country. So, so these people are out of touch. They're out of school. When I listen to Secretary Yellen talk about Bitcoin, I almost feel sorry for her. You know, she's just completely out of touch with what the asset actually is. Gary Gensler, he's on an individual jihad against the asset because he's got his job through Elizabeth Warren. So she hates crypto. They're like the Batman and Robin of the anti-crypto movement. You know what I mean? They're driving around in the anti-crypto mobile, wreaking havoc on everybody, which is so silly because you guys, at least in the UK, are like, we're not doing that. We're going to make the regulation propitious and fair. They're going to do the same thing in the UAE. And so we don't want a capital flight, and we don't want the mantle of U.S. financial services leadership to move to another country because we've got 200-year-old fossils dictating the regulatory rubric in the country. So the good news about us is that we recirculate our elites all the time, and we'll get rid of these guys, and we'll get more practical people in the room. So I'm less worried about the regulation. The other thing I would tell you, I mean, I didn't learn a lot in law school. We were talking about law school. I mean, the first thing I learned was don't be a lawyer. I mean, that was an obvious thing. But then the second thing was about property rights. And our property rights here, like in your country, go back to the Magna Carta. And so the property rights here are sacrosanct. When the IRS said that Bitcoin was intangible property, whatever the regulator wants to do, it's not going to really matter. You can't take the property from somebody.
Yep.
Okay, the property rights, despite the tribalism in the country, are still universally protected. And so we will eventually get the regulation right. So I'm less worried about that. What I'm worried about more generally is the system, post-World War II system, transitioned after 9/11. It had two seismic transitions. So we could study Bretton Woods together, and I can prove to you that Bretton Woods actually worked for industrialized Europe and worked for industrialized America from 1944 to 1971. Over that 27-year period of time, we had stable prices but rising working-class wages. Okay, my family is a direct beneficiary of that, which is why we were able to live in the American dreamscape of the middle class.
Yeah.
In 1971, when he made the decision in August to devalue the dollar and renege on the Bretton Woods Treaty and float the fiat currency, it touched off rampant inflation. So the 70s was a period of massive inflation that hurt the working class families like my family, motivated me to get a job at age 11. I mean, because we were very anxious at the time. And when Reagan got to power, the inflation was still running, but because the economy was growing faster and more technology was being onboarded, the inflation started coming down. Yeah. Okay, and so we benefited from all the deflationary forces of modern technology. Why am I bringing this all up? Because you have to step back and look at the whole continuum. So, yeah. Seismic issue number one was we took ourselves off of the Bretton Woods contract. Seismic issue number two, which was equally fateful, is we let the Chinese into the World Trade Organization, but we left them unchecked in the World Trade Organization. So Chinese came in as an emerging market. They came in as a developing nation. They were able to put up certain tariffs and protections for themselves, but they were able to export. Okay, we also allowed them to link their currency to the U.S. dollar, and the dollar was going to decline because of what we did in Bretton Woods. Yeah. And so even though China was building this huge export machinery, okay, and this manufacturing center, their currency should have gone up in value, but because we allowed them to peg it to our currency, they benefited from their currency being artificially depreciated while their economy was rising. Mm-hmm. That's how they were able to get the double-digit growth. Okay, so those seismic things that we did from a policy perspective, again, I'm not blaming anybody, I'm just being observational, okay, hurt the working class in the UK, hurt the working class, the people that run around in the yellow jackets in France, yeah. And hurt the hollowed out U.S. manufacturing. Again, all these things are addressable and all these things we can deal with, but the politicians don't like talking about any of this because it makes it look like there were shortcomings and failures in policy. And you tell me the politicians that like admitting mistakes. You know any that I'm not aware of any.
No, nor am I.
So this is what happened. Okay, it's totally fixable.
Yeah.
But you got to get the right leadership involved. You asked me this question about Bitcoin.
Yes.
So what we did in the U.S., 20 years ago, as well as the World Trade Organization for China, is we weaponized the U.S. dollar.
Okay.
So after 9/11, we decided the U.S. dollar is the currency for the world, right? It's basically our reserve currency.
Yeah.
And so we weaponized it. So we froze Iranian assets. We froze North Korean assets. Mm-hmm. We've now taken the Russians off the Swiss banking system, okay? And so we've been applying punitive sanctions towards our adversaries using the U.S. dollar. So what could happen, I hope it doesn't happen, is that people start to form currency blocks away from the United States. Now, it really won't happen because nobody has the predictability of the rule of law like the United States, except for the internet money. Because the internet money is decentralized, so you don't have to trust any central authority. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So the weird thing about the sanctions, and even Janet Yellen herself has admitted this, it has potentially accelerated the movement away from fiat currency. Okay, I just wanted to just bring that up because you asked a really good question. Do we end up with internet money, Bitcoin or something, becoming the standard?
Yeah.
In my lifetime, I'm going to predict no, but some weird things could happen where you could see nations that are hostile to the U.S. trading with Bitcoin or trading with a gold-backed denominated something or other away from the U.S. dollar because of the way the U.S. has used the dollar in terms of asserting its geopolitical will on others.
I brought up regulation of blockchain because I think it'd be remiss of me to not ask you about SBF, mm-hmm. FTX.
Sure.
Obviously, there's a regulation issue there, mm-hmm. And we all know what happened. You were obviously involved, and you can tell me about that involvement, not with the FTX scandal, of course, but you knew Sam.
Yeah. No, Sam broke my heart. I can happily talk about that.
Well, I mean, I'm interested to just understand. I think you described him as the Zuckerberg of crypto. At least that's what you saw him as. I think that's a quote from an interview I listened to.
Yeah.
Ultimately, he turns out not to be the Zuckerberg.
Well, he turns out to be the Bernie Madoff. What I said in the interview was I thought he was the Mark Zuckerberg of crypto, the revolutionary, the way Mark was on social media, but he turned out to be the Bernie Madoff. It was very, very sad, you know. It's interesting because Michael Lewis is out with a new book right now, and I watched Michael's interview, and Michael believes that he was a very well-intended guy, that some rogue things happened to. I'm probably less generous to Sam. I see Sam as somebody that was using other people's money willfully, and I think he committed the fraud that he'll end up going to jail for. I predict he'll be prosecuted, and I predict there'll be a guilty conviction in his case, because you have four of his senior executives that already pled guilty.
Yeah.
They're all going to be testifying to what they did. So I think it's very unlikely that Sam won't have a guilty verdict in his case. But I see Sam as a tragic figure, and I see what happened to his parents with great tragedy, because I have children that are Sam's age, and I liked and I trusted Sam, and I thought the world of Sam, and I thought that what he was doing with the effect of altruism, and I thought the way he was thinking about things was the appropriate way, and I enjoyed his company. And he was incredibly smart. So I'm not going to be one of these people that revises history. I was at a luggage, conveyor belt baggage claim in a European city. And the woman came over to me and she said, "Oh, you know, how could you not know that Sam was a fraud?" I said, "Well, there's a lot of things that, I got wrong. Obviously, I'm willing to admit that I got the thing wrong." And she said, "I knew he was a fraud." And I said, "You did?" I said, "But you told me several months ago that you had an account at FTX, that you had money at FTX." "Oh, I did." I said, "And so is your money frozen at FTX?" And she said, "It was." And then I looked at her. I said, "So then how could you tell me that you knew he was a fraud?"
Yeah.
So you see, what happens in our society is we revise history to make ourselves look good. Okay, there's an expression in Italian, I can translate it for you, is that we don't remember things the way they happened. We remember things the way we need to, not the way they actually happened. But I think it's very important for me to tell you what actually happened. It doesn't reflect well on me, but I'm willing to talk about it because it's raw and it's honest. And I'll say to you in front of your viewers and listeners, if I can save one person from going through the tragedy that me and my team went through by being on the wrong side of Sam Bankman-Fried, then it's worth it to me to expose my vulnerability. I find it ironic that you have leading venture capitalists and leading sovereign wealth funds and all their crisis management PR teams tell them, "Don't say a word and pretend it didn't happen and it'll blow over in 2 years." So I'm speaking about it because I don't want it to blow over in 2 years. I want people to look back and say, okay, this guy committed one of the biggest frauds in U.S. history for sure, maybe global history. How did he do it? He also bamboozled a lot of super smart people, including myself. How did he do that? And what were the lessons? So I'm going to give you one big lesson that everybody should think about. When the money is controlled by a very small group of people, they can commit a crime.
Yeah.
Okay, Bernie Madoff, he had his brother, his assistant, and an accountant across the Tappan Zee Bridge that were doing the fraud. For Mr. Bankman-Fried, it was his four cohorts that committed that fraud. If you have money here at SkyBridge, we have five different banking custodians, three different accountants, six people in our control room.
Yeah.
Okay. You have so many people involved that there's always going to be a person of conscience that will say, "Oh, that doesn't work for me."
Yeah.
You see what I mean? That's a big lesson that I learned from the whole thing.
We've discussed a lot about kind of your thoughts on markets, themes, geopolitical situations, but I want to understand more practically what that means for SkyBridge's investments.
Mm-hmm.
$580 million of your $1.8 billion
yes.
AUM is invested in digital asset related investments.
Yes.
At least that's what I read.
It's up a little bit actually because of the markets are up a little bit.
Got it.
It's probably over 600 now.
Great. And is the plan to continue to pivot or concentrate your investments in digital assets, or do you plan to diversify? Talk to me about that.
So the short answer is no, but here's what I think could happen. If we're right about Bitcoin, if Bitcoin, which is trading as we're speaking around 28,000, if there's a Bitcoin ETF and there's a halving cycle, a reduction in supply, and Wall Streeters like BlackRock go out to sell the product to their clients and Fidelity, and Bitcoin goes to 150,000, then I won't have to do anything, and my assets on the digital side will equal my assets on the non-digital and the more traditional side. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm out there every day trying to grow my assets in digital, and I'm trying to grow my assets in traditional. But I think there could be, because if we're right on the digital, there could be a time where that eclipses.
Yes.
But it won't be because I've made this strategic decision to move more money into it. It'll be through appreciation.
I guess based on that, we ask everyone that comes on the podcast for their next big idea. That's actually the tagline for the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
We've discussed Bitcoin, we've discussed AI, we've discussed blockchain more generally. Perhaps outside of that, a theme, maybe a technology that people aren't talking about so much. Can you, Anthony, give us your next big idea, an area that particularly excites you?
Well, it's in the themes that we're discussing, though. I don't really have a new theme, but I do think that there'll be these layer two digital assets that are on networks like Ethereum that are going to help us tokenize the securities industry. And so I actually thought Sam was going to be the one that did that for us. But if you're in my industry, when I started in the industry, it was called T+5. That meant if I bought stock from the exchange, it took 5 days for it to get into my account. And we went to T+3, T+2. A few weeks ago, we got down to T+1. So it's getting better. But over the internet, over the tokenization through the blockchain, it could be T+0. And so I'm working on two or three layer two products, you know, from a private equity perspective that I think can help us get there. So I think it's going to be a very big idea.
Yeah.
Because as you create more liquidity through tokenization, you can take illiquid assets like real estate, art, et cetera, start tokenizing them. It'll make those markets more efficient, less illiquid, I should say. And then the second thing that I'm working on, which is more on the non-business front, mm-hmm. is the idea of creating political leadership mm-hmm. that can confront the current malaise in our political leadership and the failure, frankly, of the two parties right now not operating in the best interest of the U.S. or the American people, but they're really operating in their own self-interest. And so there's a way to create a wedge there. You can get 10 or 15 independents into the Congress, you'll shake the whole thing up. So I'm working on that as well.
Fantastic. I think that's a lovely idea to end the interview on. Just leaves me to say thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
It's great to be here. Thank you for your time.